From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. French Polynesia's ruling Tumpara Hirata Party has won a resounding victory in the runoff round of the territorial election. Its share is twice that combined result of the two opposition parties. Walter Zeifel reports.
Vous avez voté pour la paix et la stabilité de la Polynésie française.
That's the Tapura Hoiratira party leader Edouard Fritsch thanking his supporters in his victory speech, saying they've voted for peace and stability. With 49% of the vote, the party was almost 20% ahead of its closest rival. The electoral system rewards the party coming first, which means it has now 38 seats in the 57-member assembly. That's twice the number of seats won by the two opposition parties put together. The Tahoeira leader Gaston Floss, who was from standing because of a corruption conviction, was disappointed and said he could not congratulate the winner.
When you see all the cheating, all the fiddling, everything that is false and illegal, be it by the French state or by Edouard Fritsch, I won't use the right word, but simply say it's unbearable.
Gaston Floss took issue with some convicted politicians being allowed to stand, while others like him have been banned. Mr. Fritsch had also convictions in the past term and was forced to reimburse the taxpayer more than $80,000 of funds abused at the time when he was still a Tahoeira politician. The pro-independence leader Oscar Temaru had campaigned on the subject of probity, pointing out that the Tapura stood 9 candidates with convictions for misspending public funds. He says he will continue his battle.
I'm against cronyism, complicity, all sorts of betrayal that we've endured, and also against these politics of prostitution.
The Tapura election victory is already being challenged by citizen Yves Conroy, who lodged a complaint with the Supreme Court in France, accusing Mr. Fritsch and four ministers of violating the electoral law, which bans politicians from using taxpayers' money to travel to political meetings. Mr. Conroy, who was instrumental in the demise of Gaston Floss for his corruption convictions, is adamant that there is no escape for Mr. Fritsch because of the case law emanating from the Nicolas Sarkozy affair. It is not known if the Tahoeira will also file a formal challenge to back up its allegations of cheating. In 2004, it succeeded in getting the Tahiti election annulled after saying that the blue curtains at the voting booths in Mahina favoured the Tavini of Mr. Temaru. Both Edouard Fritsch and Gaston Floss are to appear in the criminal court at a date yet to be set for their actions as former and current mayors of the town of Pire. They are alleged to have arranged for the town administration to pay for the water supply to the upmarket Erima neighbourhood where Floss used to live. The new assembly is due to be convened on the 17th of May to elect an assembly president and then later to choose the president of the territorial government. This is Walter Zweifel.
As it appears, Hawaii's Big Island, the number of residents evacuating the rising new lava flows threatened to destroy their home. It's almost been a week since the volcano began erupting, following ongoing seismic activity. The biggest tremor was 6.9 that struck over last weekend and the strongest recorded in the state in over 40 years. Sarah Viatulatui has more.
Kilauea is located on the southeastern side of Hawaii's Big Island and has a reputation as one of the world's most active volcanoes. Close to 3,000 residents in Lanipuna Gardens have now been told to evacuate after some 1,800 residents of Leilani Estates had to get out. Officials report there are now at least 14 fissures now and dozens of homes have been destroyed by hot lava. People are being warned to heed safety warnings while scientists monitor the eruption more closely to get answers. A geologist from the U.S. Geological Survey, Janet Babb, says that the situation is fluid as seismic activity is still being recorded.
We're learning things, and so, one of the things, for instance, we're collecting lava samples, samples of each fissure as they've erupted, and so those samples have now been analyzed, and so we're beginning to understand more about what's going on below the ground.
Local communities are stepping up to help volcano-affected residents as Civil Defence opens a new recovery information and assistance centre at a local church. Church Secretary and Business Manager Bernice Walker says they've been inundated with hundreds of people.
There is relief that their stuff got taken out. There's frustration because things don't happen quick enough. There's happiness because loved ones are safe. There's worry because animals are left behind. I mean, there's every emotion under the sun that you can think of that happens in times of crisis like we're having.
Bernice Walker says the church is happy to be able to connect people to get the help they need.
It's open to all the victims who need information, a place to stay, doctors, rides to go somewhere, information who might have a room or who may have trucks to haul things out. Things like that.
The Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Pahoa will be open between 9 and 3 p.m. weekdays. One fissure appeared 2 kilometres from the Puna geothermal plant that had 60,000 gallons of a highly flammable liquid on site. Hawaii County Civil Defence Administrator Talmadge Magno has assured worried locals.
As I said, there's no, the last footage I saw, there's no flow, it's just a fissure.
But he admits there is no sign of the volcano's activities slowing down with a lot of magma underground. The land size now covered by the new lava flow is said to equate to 100 football fields. Many roads are still closed and there are no fly zones put in place given the toxic gases of sulfur dioxide as well as the lava flow that continue to pose a danger. Residents who are allowed to return to check in on their properties are being asked to adhere to strict instructions by authorities. This is Saravui Talatu.
A prominent leader and businessman on Bougainville says the latest statements from Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister Peter O'Neill on the region's referendum are contradictory. Last week, Mr. O'Neill told Business Forum in Australia that next year's Bougainville referendum is not about independence. He says the government will ensure the letter and spirit of the Bougainville peace agreement is followed, but says he is sure when it comes to the ratification, all MPs in the national parliament will vote in the interest of a unified and harmonious country. Martin Moriarty, who once headed the former Bougainville interim government and was a leader in the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, told Don Wiseman the statements from Mr. O'Neill are confusing.
They've already said it's too late. That effort is too late, much too late. They should have come earlier. And some of these prime ministers that they are trying to come, they were part and parcel of the problem. For example, Robert Ndamaliu, when he was the prime minister in 1990, the call-out order was made under which the security forces operated. And then my friend Julius Chen, of course, you know 1997, the same line issue. But the big majority of people, Bougainvillians, I think, to me, from my own assessment, I think there's no turning back.
Do you think there was a time when maybe they could have had an effect?
I think, you know, the case with Bougainville, it's got history, rich history, past history, where, you know, in the 1900s, early 1900s, in the 60s, people at that time, the leaders at that time, they were already longing for this day to come. So basically, I think for the prime ministers who come at this point in time, as I said, at the 11th hour, maybe it's a kind of a waste of time. They should have come earlier. They should have come earlier.
Prime Minister Peter O'Neill is also singing the same tune. He says he'll ensure that the vote goes ahead, but he wants to maintain the unity of PNG. He's also reminded people that after the vote, it then goes to the National Parliament for a final decision to be made. Do many Bougainvillians understand that, that it's actually going to, in the end, come down to the National Parliament making a decision?
Yes, but it is an absolute majority, 90%. I don't think, you know, Papua New Guinea will have any choice because the will of the people will be just that even the international community is going to respect it. That's how I look at it. There will be a backlash on PNG from the international community because this process is going to be monitored or it's been monitored by the international community and the UN.
It's getting pretty close now, isn't it? It's just about, what, 15 months away, this vote. Is there excitement building?
There is a lot of excitement. They are looking forward to the day, the 15th of May, June 2019. They are all talking about it. The Commonwealth for the referendum is being worked on. By April, the Commonwealth should be ready, all completed. And awareness is taking place right now, right across the region. And the great majority of people, they just cannot simply wait. The day is coming. They know what they want.
World Vision says basic relief has been distributed to most of the accessible parts of Papua New Guinea, and the post-quake operation is now moving towards a rehabilitation focus as people are trying to get their lives back together. Country Director Heather McLeod has just returned from Mound Bosevi area and told Jenny Meyer, although tribal violence is hampering aid in Hela province, in other areas such as the Southern Highlands, children are returning to school and most people now have basic shelter.
And one of the things that the teachers were saying is slowly the kids are coming back to school. Nearly all of them are now back in school, but they're not concentrating very well because they're still aftershocks. So we were talking about the fact that getting children back to school is really important and getting children into routines again and to know that, and for them to be around people when these aftershocks are happening. And but over time, they're adjusting, and they say already they're beginning to adjust to the aftershocks, but there's still a lot of fear. What does this mean? Are they going to get worse again? So it's encouraging that children are coming back to school. And I was very impressed by the quality of the leadership in the village that I was in yesterday in terms of wanting to support the people and make sure that their villages were well cared for.
What about Hela province? We've heard that there's significant unrest there and most agencies have pulled out of Tari and the whole of Hela province. Is that the case for World Vision?
We made a decision not to work in Hela. The Southern Highlands is an area where we chose to work and discussed that with the interagency group. We're partnering with the Evangelical Church because it's not an area we normally work in, and so the Evangelical Church has schools and health posts and a strong network in that particular area, which is why we chose to work in the Southern Highlands, which is also equally affected. So there is some work going on in Hela, but it's certainly restricted because of the violence that's there at the moment.
So how long do you expect that you will be active in Southern Highlands?
We're moving to the end of that first release phase where you're getting those essential items out. And the next phase, which will be funded by the New Zealand government, is to look at getting better water and sanitation in the villages where we've been and some others as well. So looking at having a water tank rather than only relying on water tablets, the aqua taps, getting it for the health posts in particular, because, of course, if you don't have water in a health post, you can't provide good health care. And also providing good water and sanitation for the schools. So where there are schools, trying to get those done. So we're moving into a new phase in the next few weeks. That is that rehabilitation phase and moving out of the immediate emergency phase. So for the next 6 to 9 months, we will be working away at really getting these things rebuilt and re-established again, because a lot of them had water tanks and they were destroyed by the earthquake.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The central province of Solomon Islands is planning to ban logging from its Nageli Islands. Its premier, Patrick Vasuni, says this is because it suspects trees are being over-harvested. He says his office is requesting a survey of logging activity to be conducted by the Ministry of the Environment. He says proof over the over-harvesting is the only way his government can legally ban logging on the island. Patrick Vasuni says there are 4 logging companies operating in the Nageli group, and 2 more are seeking logging licenses. He speaks next to Jamie Tahana.
There are so many people within Gela Island that they are so concerned about logging issue in Gela, in central province. So what my government, or what my executive is going to do, is to invite the Ministry of the Environment to come down and conduct a survey on Gela Island with regard to logging operations here in Gela. And once that survey confirms that Gela Island has been overlogged, then my executive will make a firm decision to to put a ban, total ban on logging operations in Gela, in Central Province. We are yet to invite the environment group from the Ministry of Environment to come and conduct that survey, because most people do not want logging to be conducted or to be operated within Gela, in Central Province. We already submitted a report to the Ministry of Environment for an assessment team to come over to Tulagi and then to conduct the survey on Gela.
To my understanding, logging interests always have quite a level of power in Solomon Islands, given the lack of revenue sources. I would assume you have some people that would not be happy with this, that might be putting pressure on your government not to go ahead with this idea.
Well, currently, yes, we receive much pressure or more pressure from our people, trying convincing us to stop logging internal province. But according to our Forestry Act, we don't have the provincial governments don't have the total power to stop logging operations. Provincial governments only have power to issue license for the loggers to do logging in any province. That's why, in respect of what our good people of Gela are calling for, that is why we are trying to get the environment team to come down to conduct assessment in Gela.
And how many logging operations are there in Gela?
Currently, there are four logging operations here in Gela, and we have received two more applications for us to conduct a timber rights hearing from these two new applicants. But again, because of pressure from our people, we are yet to consider convening that meeting for the timber rights hearing.
So, if this survey is carried out and if it comes back that you are experiencing overharvesting of logs, what then are you able legally to do, given you said you have limited powers?
Well, in that Forestry Act, we have a power to ban logging if the report confirms that Gela has been overlogged.
Going back to my earlier question, I was saying that there's not a lot of revenue sources for provincial governments, it's quite rare for a provincial government to take the stance that you're taking. Do you have alternative revenue sources planned, or is logging not such a big revenue source for your province?
Yeah, currently we don't benefit very much on logging, on these four loggers who are currently operating in logging, because even now that we are talking, they fail to pay up their business license. So we have some alternatives. If there is a total ban on logging, there are other areas that we can get money once we stop logging operations in Gela. But currently we have another logging operating in Russell, so we will still have generating money coming up from that logging that is currently operating in Russell. But for Gela, for that matter, because of the demand or outcry of our people, we have to respect them and to call this survey to be conducted here in Gela.
And just in terms of some timelines, when do you anticipate putting in a request for a survey team to come over, and how long will it take before they can bring in their report and that sort of thing?
The Province Secretary has been working on that request already last week, so we hope perhaps at this time that we are talking now, perhaps he has already submitted that formal request to the Ministry of Environment.
And when's the next Provincial Assembly?
The Provincial Assembly will convene sometime in August, September, August this year. But because of the sensitivity of that report, the executive can sit at any time as soon as we receive that report.
A journalism educator in the Pacific says more training and development for the region's journalists would be better for protecting the media and improve transparency in the region. The coordinator of the University of South Pacific Journalism Program, Shagya Singh, says university scholarships for journalists are scarce and training opportunities are far behind other parts of the world. Dr. Singh told Sally Round the lack of homegrown research into media landscape is also a major gap.
The research is so important to look into the nature and health of journalism in the Pacific region. There is not much consistent research in Pacific media to begin with. And then moreover, it's the same people doing much of the research. So the different perspectives are lacking. So we've got a scarcity of research, and then we've also got a scarcity of perspectives. Much of the research that is done on Pacific media is done by outsiders, you know, which is important. We are not dismissing research by outsiders. In fact, outsider research is really, really crucial because outsider perspective is usually considered less biased as it is deemed freer of local cultural constraints. It's more neutral and can be very illuminating. However, it's crucial to have homegrown researchers also for a more balanced outcome. It goes without saying that those who are closest to a problem, that is the locals, understand the problem best, and they may have the best solution. So generally speaking, there is a lack of insider perspective in Pacific research. And the problem is we lack the local capacity for consistent research. And this lack of insider perspective is a gap that can be addressed through training and development. This is the crux of my argument.
We've just marked World Press Freedom Day. It's pretty dire by all accounts, and all the measures that seem to be coming out, things aren't improving. What's your view?
The state of media freedom is a constant challenge. The condition of media freedom is never in a perfect state and never will be. It's a constant battle, as you know, not just in Fiji in the Pacific, but even in developed countries like Australia and New Zealand, which have major security concerns. Of course, a fragile multi-ethnic country like Fiji, with a history of political tensions and coups, has very legitimate national security concerns. Our problem as journalists is that the sweeping nature of some of the legislation makes life very risky for our journalists. Okay, they have huge fines and jail terms hanging over their heads. And this chilling effect is neither good for the health of journalism, nor democracy, nor the country, nor its citizens. And it goes back to what we were discussing earlier on about training and development. Right? The media sector becomes an easier target for stronger legislation if it commits too many professional fouls. Media lose public support, and the government is emboldened to tighten the noose. And you can see this trend in the Pacific. Governments complaining about ethical and professional breaches by the media, then threatening to implement, already implementing, harsher laws. So what I'm saying is that training and development is not a 100% guarantee against harsher legislation, but it still offers at least some protections.
Who's going to provide this training and development? Where's it coming from?
You know, this affects everybody in the country. And the training and development that I'm talking about has to be a joint collaborative effort between government. We have to include government because governments are so big and influential in the Pacific. We need to learn to work with government. Also at the NGO sector, and the NGO sector, I must say, is doing quite a bit of work. The Citizens Constitutional Forum in Fiji recently had training for local journalists. The corporate sector could be more forthcoming because the corporate sector is also affected by an instability and the state and quality of the media in the country, and especially the aid donors, because they also stand to benefit by having a well-trained journalist corps in a country. Right? Because in the past, the media has been blamed, especially the Solomon Islands and Fiji, for at least not being responsible, but inciting and worsening fragile situations.
But I mean, it takes two to tango. I mean, you may have a well-trained media, but what about governments who are not offering up information?
Yeah, you know, that's another topic, and that's really another discussion. I mean, of course, governments are not offering information. That's correct. We've got this freedom of information legislation that is waiting implementation in many countries. Promises have been made. They have not been kept. But, you know, the government's reluctance to share and impart information should not in any way be an obstacle to providing training for journalists. A well-trained journalist will find the information one way or another.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address, pcjmedia@gmail.com. Once again, pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.